You are about to enter the pop, pulp, and subcultural minds of several individuals. What may leak into the ether can sometimes be too strange, too confusing for the average human mind. When nerds assemble. Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Cookie.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
And we have got lots of fabulous things to discuss this week. First, though, is a bit of, well, old news, but it slipped under the radar for me, and then it just kind of popped up, and that was the fact that Sweary teased at Gamescom that there could be a Deadly Premonition 2 on the way at some point.
That would be pretty cool. I quite enjoy the first one.
I immensely enjoyed the first one. I enjoyed Deadly Premonition so much because I used it as a game to get over Fallout New Vegas after getting it. I used
which I'm still playing.
I used it to wash away the bad taste that Fallout New Vegas had left in my mouth. Because at the time, the 360 version was incredibly buggy. And I just was not liking things at all. So...
I'll just chip in now about Fallout New Vegas. You were saying at that time it was incredibly buggy.
I'm not sure.
Incredibly buggy.
It's still incredibly buggy. I will not be going back to it. I'm barely coping with Skyrim still having the odd issue.
I'm getting into the habit of doing saves every time I do something that I don't want to have to redo.
Yeah. I could totally get that.
I'll leave it at that.
I think just to explain to people who perhaps are somehow strangely unfamiliar with Deadly Premonition, otherwise known as Red Sea Profile in the US, because we apparently have lots of US listeners, so it might be helpful to refer to it as such. It was a quirky Japanese game that was initially, I think, developed for the PS2, missed that generation. So it ended up coming out initially on PS3 in Japan and I believe America, and then it was released on 360 in Europe and America. And basically it's the video game of Twin Peaks.
It is absolutely bonkers.
For all intents and purposes, FBI agent goes to a small town in the middle of nowhere. There's lots of trees. There's lots of murders. Quite frankly, it's Twin Peaks.
Are there damn fine apple pies?
There is a baking obsession, though.
Okay.
And there's damn fine coffee as well that actually talk to you.
Yes. Oh, that was
really?
Yeah, really. The coffee would talk to you.
I'm going to have to get this now.
The mechanics, like actually trying to play it, could get quite frustrating at times. It had this weird third person thing going on where it hadn't quite gotten over what the early Resident Evils tended to do to you, which, released from Capcom, but Deadly Premonition was fantastic, and it was amazing how much it split, like, the reviews community.
Yeah, you either loved it or you liked it. I mean, I actually was quite honoured to do a review for it on a website that I was on at the time, and I actually put on there that it was so bad, it's just so good at the same time. It was one of those games that if you looked at the mechanics and you judged it on the mechanics alone, then it should have failed. But if you took in all the quirkiness and took it for what it was a blinding game. It was brilliant.
Even though the story was absolutely insane in places, I just loved it for the insanity that it was. It was just this mishmash of various homages to things like 80s movies and people talking about 80s movies, and it was based on real life conversations that Sweary and the team had with each other about talking about 80s movies, because there's this whole thing where you're just driving in a car down an American small town and you're talking with yourself about 80s movies. What was it Lady Hawk, is that
believe so, yes.
Yeah, Lady Hawk was one of the ones that gets talked about. And it's just funny that when I played the game the first time around, I believe, was when Film 4 started repeating Lady Hawk a lot. Like, every so often now they're showing it. And so I was like, what film are they on about? And then I was like, and then I ended up watching it for the first time. And I was just like, that film with thingy and thingy. And that's why they're talking about it like that. Brilliant. So it's just this weird game where the mechanics are a bit strange, but they try to replicate real life, and it tries to get you to do everyday things.
It does.
And that was one of the things that Spiro was adamant about kind of emphasising, and he says that he'll want to bring back that to a second game if he makes one. In the
interview
I saw.
That would be pretty awesome.
No, I
would actually like that quite a lot, to be fair. I was shocked at the original. It was just brilliant.
I think he's also interested in making sure that coffee fortune telling is brought back properly as well. Maybe boosting
Even
it
better.
A bit.
That'd be awesome.
And making it perhaps a slightly more important game mechanic in of itself.
And coffee fortune telling.
Oh, yes. Forget tea leaves. Tea leaves are last
gone.
Decade.
Good. I hate tea.
It's
tea
when...
leaves are just so last century.
Yeah,
it's all about
coffee.
Coffee now.
Yeah, coffee's where it's at. It's the Java. The Java is the important thing.
Yeah.
I approve.
It would be kind of cool if a sequel was made. I mean, I'm not sure how well the original did for sales, but I think if there's one thing that could be said about Japanese games is that regardless of whether or not they sell well, if there's a fan base that likes the quirkiness, they have this habit of coming back and sort of biting everyone in the arse later on. So
how easy do you think it would be to actually carry on the story? Because I mean, it seems to me like it was fairly well wrapped up by then.
Without any spoilers, unless... I'm not sure where they'd go. Maybe maybe a protege.
There's two places like that in America.
Of course, that's the whole point. That's the whole point. There's the fact that it was an everyday American town.
True.
And it was, you know, it was making light of the fact that so many of these towns that had grown up around various industries, like logging or mining, you know, are actually quite identical. And the fact that they're obviously deindustrialized as well because, you know, either the resources have dried up or it's not cheap to actually source it from there anymore. And there's loads of towns like that across America. So the idea of stuff going weird and wonderful in another town is great. And quite frankly, considering the immense amount of mysticism and supernatural elements that are actually in the first game, who's to say things can't come back? It strikes me that this is a game where dead does not necessarily mean dead.
Definitely not.
I mean, it seemed to me almost like a cross between Twin Peaks and Silent Hill.
Definitely. So if that hasn't convinced anyone listening to play it, if they haven't already played it, well then... quite frankly, there's no hope for you. There's nothing we can do to help you.
Go out now, pause the podcast, and buy it.
Well, and don't forget, you don't actually have to go out and physically buy the game because the 360 version is available on Games on Demand.
And well, that'll be cheaper if you can find it in the shops.
That's a good
point. Yeah.
I do remember when they initially released it on Play on Demand. Quite well after the initial game had been out on disc, and there was like a pricing error. I can't remember if it was either £5 more expensive than it should have been or £5 cheaper, but that there was a pricing error initially, which has been sorted for many months now. But anyway, moving on.
Although hang on, just to chip in here, or someone who hasn't played it.
Yeah.
Now, I like Silent Hill. Up to about game 3.
Yeah.
Would it appeal to me?
Do you like quirky Japanese narratives, which you're not quite sure where they're going, but you hope they're going to go somewhere?
Yes.
Well, then you'll like this.
You'll like it, yeah.
I'll have to see if I can pick it up then.
I don't like horror games. I don't like really Resident Evil. I haven't played much Silent Hill, but I absolutely love this game. Don't ask me why, it just appealed to me, and I think it's because it's more in line with like Twin Peaks and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Whole different transition there. So yeah,
it's just at the time I wasn't entirely sure about the reception it was getting, because it seemed to be getting a lot of oh, it's so bad it's good, or it's good because it's quirky, it's good despite little problems.
I think what is needed is a knowledge of at least a basic knowledge of Twin Peaks, and B, a knowledge of Silent Hill, and C, a slight knowledge of the fact that certain Japanese creators have interesting concepts about the supernatural and life and death. And if you can keep all that in your head whilst you play, then you'll have a chance to actually appreciate the game and enjoy it, basically.
I will have to give it a go. I would have preferred, because there wasn't a demo, was there?
No. I mean, it was
would have preferred, a bit of a tinker with it.
Okay, well, I have a plan for you then.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'll bring it down with me to Eurogamer if you want.
Yay! There we go.
How about sorted?
Sorted. Making people's
I'll convert
most
you all one by one.
I think I'm going to move us on to our next bit of news, which is Valve's, to use the term lightly, hardware revealed, and it's called Big Picture.
Yay!
Yeah, Big Picture. Now what? As we had to discuss this before we started, so that we could get our heads around it, and we've realised that it isn't about virtual reality, right, guys?
Nope. It's not as cool as that.
No.
It's not as future 1980s.
No.
It's not like that scene out of, I think, in Back to the Future 2, doesn't one of the kids play around with a virtual headset?
Yes,
Mighty Junior does. So yeah, it's not like that. No, it's literally Big Picture, as in you get your regular gaming machine, i.e. something that has an operating system and is either PC shaped, CPU shaped or laptop shaped, maybe even a Mac, and you use a HDMI cable, oh my gosh, and plug it into the back of that thing, and then you plug the end of that into a TV, and oh my god, all of a sudden you have Big Picture.
And you can control it with a joypad rather than a mouse.
Yes.
Although you can still use it.
Yeah, you still can. Yeah. But you don't.
I will. if I were to get it, I would still use it with keyboard and mouse.
You see, I'm trying to see how this is any different for anyone who just happened to have a HDMI port on their computer already, happened to be already using a HDMI TV as a computer monitor already. Can people see where I'm going with this?
Yes.
Yeah,
and the answer is, it's not much different at all. It's just done so that you don't have to put... If you've got a joypad in your hand and you're wanting to select a game and then play that with a joypad, or you're playing a game with a joypad and then you want to quit out of that, select another one and not put the joypad down, you don't have to with this. You don't have to put the joypad down, pick up a mouse, select that, pick up the joypad again. That's it, really.
Do you know what? I'll believe that when it works with some of the older games, like Morrowind.
Yeah, it won't.
Yeah,
it won't.
That's my disappointment, because I've always wanted to try and properly configure Morrowind to at least work with my Xbox 360 PC controller.
Well, I can hear angry PC fans.
You say already. That, but it feels very comfortable and leads to less RSI, I tend to find.
Well, I played a few hours of it on the Xbox. I had the Xbox version of Morrowind.
Yeah, you don't play the Xbox version of Morrowind, though. You play the PC version of Morrowind if you wish to retain your sanity.
With plugins.
Well, not just that, but just the simple fact that you're less likely to be fudged over by not disposing of bodies and closing doors in the PC version, whereas in the Xbox version, it was kind of like, huh, I seem to have not closed lots of doors, and I seem not to have disposed of lots of bodies, and everything's slowing down and going horrible.
It's going, bleh.
Yeah, but going back to big picture, I mean, it's, to me, it seems that basically it's for those people who just happen to have the space and the luck to have a 52-inch TV in their living room, or bigger, and they can just maybe upscale better to that huge screen.
It's Steam for your home cinema system.
Yeah, pretty much.
Which I would like if it's, well, even then, obviously, PC speakers, they're usually quite, well, you can get them quite good. You know, obviously, you can get dedicated, like, 5.1 and 7.1 surround sound anyway on them. So it's, even if you hook it up to, you know, your home cinema system, it's basically so that you can play PC games while sitting on the sofa rather than on a computer chair. Yeah.
It's effectively a sort of a Games for Windows wrapper, but without the Games for Windows-ness.
Yeah.
So everyone can breathe a sigh of relief. If you've ever used Games for Windows, which I have, it's bloody awful. But I like the idea of, if a game is Games for Windows, it will recognise that you've got a 360 controller and remap the controls to it. That's a massive advantage.
Yeah.
So this is effectively the same kind of thing, except it's wrapped around Steam in the same way.
Which is actually quite a cool idea when you think about it.
I do like the idea.
Yeah. I just think the people that are going to majorly benefit from this are even people who decide to trail very long HDMI cables from their huge CPU sort of box all the way to their living room. Or people with laptops that were running the games quite well already.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if we're trying to couple that in with the sound issues, then, because obviously it's going to be a pain in the ass. Because the thing is that you're only going to get your 5.1 surround sound on a laptop if it's got a sound card that can handle that. And yeah. There's not actually many laptops out there, I would say, they've got sound cards that could deal with that.
Although saying that, you can actually buy USB sound cards, which can plug in, obviously, via USB. So that might be another option.
I'm just failing to see the point in a bit.
Yeah.
In the whole thing.
Who knows? Maybe it's a combination of, please keep using Steam, and they can point that as a... You can use that as an interface to developers who are wanting to put their games on Steam.
Yep.
Or even if they're wanting to maybe push it, if anyone wants to develop, you know, to Alienware or, you know, someone like that.
True.
So they can sell an Alienware Steam living room PC.
Also, if you have your mates around for some co-op games... That's going to be easier to play with a couple of pads on a big screen, isn't it?
It is, but then you know. You're still going to have to rely on the game actually supporting it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're going to rely on that, but that does give you more... It does give developers more scope.
It does.
To do that sort of thing with the PC.
Does it really? Quite cool. Does it really, though? Because obviously the PC available needs to be able to handle on the same device multiplayer, and then... Because obviously you can't have multiple HDMI, even if you've got a couple of HDMI ports on your TV or a splitter, you're not going to be able to display, in theory with most TVs, multiple HDMI displays from different sources at the same time.
Well, no, because the TV would only support 1080p maximum.
Yeah.
Mm.
It would all depend on what the changes are back end. With Steam, you know, where you know, they can say, you know, we're doing this from this point on. We would like it if you say, Steam big screen certified, or whatever they want to call it.
Okay.
And then they can say, this game will support this, this, and this. It's always been a problem with PC. For example, I don't think the PC versions of Left 4 Dead support split screen. If anyone can correct me on that, then... That'd be great.
I'm pretty sure they don't support split screen.
Yeah, whereas the 360 versions do. So,
yeah.
Where's the sense in that? I simply do not understand how a machine with half a gig of RAM from 6 or 7 years ago now can do games like that split screen, but you're sitting on your PC and it just, no split screen for you.
Stuart, going back.
It's probably because it was fairly kind of uncalled for in a way. Because, I mean, yeah, I think part of the reason why they're trying to get it into the living room rather than just, you know, kind of on the computer is basically so that you can improve the amount of games and the variety of games as well. So
exactly that's what I mean. Steam itself is a very good platform.
Yes.
And I can see them wanting to, maybe this is their angle on Games for Windows. Games for Windows, as I've said, did the positive that it, if you have a 360 wired pad or a wireless pad with a dongle, if it detects the pad, it will remap the controls. That's a massive positive for a lot of people. There are a lot of games that play really well with a 360 pad. So if they can say that they're making Steam as a whole, as well as just the interface, friendlier for the living room, then that can only be a positive, and it's something else for Valve to push with it.
Yeah. And like you say, you can develop the games in different directions. You've got the bigger screen.
Yeah.
And you know, it's also quite interesting because perhaps Valve are looking at, you know, the console market is still quite big. There will be new hardware next year.
Yeah.
In the meantime, could this be a way of getting people who like to play games on their big screen to actually turn to PC gaming and keep their big screens?
Exactly.
You know, it's quite clever when you think about it, because I know a lot of people who are fed up with waiting for new hardware, and I know several people who've already gone out and bought PCs for PC gaming and said goodbye to the Xbox or PS3, and I know a lot of other people who are thinking about it.
Yeah.
And this could be the icing on the cake for them.
I think it's a very interesting move by Steam, because they're doing, you know, by Valve, they're doing an entirely software approach.
Yeah.
And I think it's insane to think they're not pushing the whole, please do a Steam box to various manufacturers and saying, no, we can do it this way. If you want to flog a game box and put our logo on the box, and it will work in such and such a way, and, you know, promise it will be easy, and people won't have to, you know, pull their hair out with all the typical PC gaming problems, then that's going to be a plus to a lot of people.
Yes, definitely.
And I think to a certain extent, I think perhaps Valve's actually realizing that, more and more games are actually using more interesting interfaces, you know, stuff like motion controls and even like stuff like Kinect or tablets and whatnot. Perhaps they're trying to kind of get their foot in the door with actually changing the hardware, because you can't really do that kind of thing with just a desktop.
Because getting into the whole hardware manufacturing and hardware development, that's a very expensive thing to do. And I can understand why Valve would not want to go anywhere near that. But to make what they're doing, what they're offering, I mean, Steam is by far the most popular way of buying and playing games on PCs, isn't it?
Yes.
So I can understand why they're trying to do this approach. And then they can sell it along and say, look what you can do with it. People want new hardware. You can sell it. Put our software on it.
That makes a lot of sense, I suppose. I mean, basically they're saying, oh, look, a PC can be like a console. And trying to sneak in that way, basically, into people's living rooms in a more prominent position than in a more prominent position than the lone teenager sitting in the family living room with a laptop on his lap, gaming away at something because he's been forced to spend at least a bit of face time with said family.
The big appeal for consoles, apart from the PS3, with its installing and massive patches, is that once you get a game, it's there.
It works.
You don't have to install it, and any updates are usually very quick.
Yes.
So there's no problem with it. And the thing with the PS3 is that it's far too much like a PC, in that it will need a big update, and you have to sit there while it downloads it, and then it has to install it. That's the only console which does that.
Mm.
It's the PC and the PS3, and that's the downside to both of those platforms, that you have to, you know, do all that. Whereas Steam, even if you're not touching the game, if you boot up your PC and it's got Steam, as soon as Steam starts up, it checks to see if there are any updates, and it automatically grabs them for you.
Yeah.
So it's that's a level of automation for you already.
I mean, to a certain extent, you kind of need to do that in order, like, say, for example, if you're if you've got like an online game and you're kind of encountering people on it that obviously have I don't know, say, the new equipment out or something like that.
Yeah.
Then you kind of need to be able to automatically kind of download the download the information to actually kind of display that.
Yeah, everyone has to be on the same version. Everyone has to have the same level playing field right there.
Yeah.
And of course, there's nothing worse than if you're wanting to join an online game and you sit down and you switch on your computer or your console and you can see people are online playing, you know, game X. You log in, update required.
Yeah.
And you have to sit there for half an hour while it downloads a big patch.
Like,
so, verdict on Valve's big picture?
They're trying to make PC gaming a little bit more friendly to the living room, and that can only be a good thing.
Okay, I could live with that. Still
want the goggles, though.
Still want the goggles.
I don't want the goggles, I do still kind of want the goggles.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I'm sorry. I want holodeck. I was stopped short of nothing but holodeck.
Yes. And okay. I want an EMH. So he can be surly with me.
The big thing that we wanted to talk about this week as our feature discussion is probably going to be a big nostalgia trip for us and for you even. We want to talk about our first gaming memories. What did we play first and how has it affected our gaming tastes of today? So prepare for a buttload of nostalgia, essentially, as we take you down our various memory lanes. Who would like to go first? I personally kind of think we should maybe go in age order, so for those who have historically the earliest memories maybe should go first, but maybe I'm being too cheeky here.
How long have you got?
Now
I'm just maybe hinting that the oldest person should go first.
Hello.
Retroid, yeah. What is your first gaming memory?
Oh, now then, well, there are a few. Probably my first gaming memory would be my next door neighbour used to babysit me. And their eldest son, who was about 6 or 7 years older than me, had an original Wood Effect Atari 2600. And far as I can recall, that's the first gaming system I ever touched, especially in the home. Now, I can't remember much about it, but I do remember playing games like Breakout. And he may even have had Pitfall as well. Now, sorry, go on.
These are all names that sadly mean nothing to me, despite my recent activities. Except for the Atari 2600, obviously.
You don't remember Pitfall?
Pitfall was ace. It came out on the Mega Drive as well, didn't it?
An updated version did, yeah.
Yeah.
That's one with, like, swinging across, like, crocodiles and stuff, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah. Trees in the background, sort of a yellow strip, which was supposed to be sand, and you had a little subterranean level, and you'd be jumping over scorpions, snakes, and there'd be a swinging rope over pools of water, which sometimes had three crocodiles. Yeah. And the idea was with the crocodiles, they would open their mouths and then they would close them, and there'd be a set amount of time between, you know, those two frames of animation.
Mm.
And you could if you timed it right, you could jump on the noses of each one and then, be over across the other side without losing life, and that was hell to do. But you ran through this this forest, and you collected gold and diamond rings and things like that. It is available on Games Room, the ill-fated 360 retro game hub, which I bought a sickening amount of games for. I was the one who bought the games for that. So the neighbour had an Atari 2600. I played games on that, but I was very young with that. And then I remember my uncle got a ZX80, not a ZX81, but a ZX80, and that was a black and white only forerunner to the ZX Spectrum, flat keyboard. So it wasn't even the rubber keyboard. And the most fun I had with that was I typed in a program listing.
Ooh.
And it didn't actually take that long because it only had something like a 1K of RAM.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to imagine 1K of RAM and actually failing at this point.
I know. So the whole idea of computers and programs and just the entire idea that a television was something that you could sit down in front of and control what was going on the screen. That was entirely new. VCRs were not common at that time. So you couldn't even put something on that you wanted to watch. It was, if it was 8 o'clock and you wanted to watch the program at 8 o'clock, you had to be arse on seat in front of the screen. No iPlayer or anything like that. And then, of course, family trips and family holidays to Blackpool. And this was the heyday of the arcades.
Yes.
And I remember walking down, there was one arcade in particular where it must have had one particular avenue where it was just, it must have been about 36 arcade machines. All different machines, either side. And you could just walk down with your change, and it was 10p a credit.
Sounds awesome.
And you could just pick whichever game you wanted to play, and it was things like 1942, Pac-Man, Kung Fu Master. And a lot of the Twitch gaming, which people are rediscovering now on the App Store, where it's just a very simple formula, where you just collect something, or you complete enemy waves. That's what that harks back to, and that's why I quite enjoy a lot of the Xbox Live Arcade, PSN, PSP Minis. That's what I really enjoy. And then, of course, when it came to... I'd play those on holiday, and I'd play 1942 and Commando. I'd come home, and I'd want to play them at home too. And we got a Vectrex. Yes, a Vectrex.
Awesome.
And I remember they were on sale in Woolworths, and the games were something like £3.50 each. Because effectively, I think the company had cut its losses and killed it off, and they were just selling off stock.
Okay.
But yeah, the Vectrex is an amazing machine, which, if anyone doesn't know, it had a vector monitor. It didn't build it up in dots and pixels. It drew specifically only the lines it needed on the screen. So if you've seen Wireframe, it looked like that, except it was far sharper because it was just painting the lines on the phosphor as it required. It wasn't having to do them step by step. It was just a line from top left to bottom right, and it was just a straight line. And you had to put coloured screens over it because the monitor was black and white. And then, of course, I went through Commodore 64, Commodore 16, Amiga. And I played on friends' ZX Spectrums and even some people who had CPCs, the poor souls.
Oi.
I know, I had to. I like the CPC. It just it was the ginger haired child at school. The vast majority of people had ZX Spectrums.
Or Commodore 64s.
People, yeah, like me, who had Commodore 64s as their main machine.
Sure.
One or two friends who had CPCs. And the thing is, I enjoyed playing on them all.
Hmm.
I wasn't a snob when it came to... I'm not touching that. It was a, oh, you've got something I haven't played. Give me.
Yes.
So I think the critical question at this point is, how has your first experiences with video games affected what you play now, at least stuff that comes out either, you know, from AAA to indie?
Now, platforming and what I'd call, arcade shmups are the two things which have stayed with me. So the classic sort of, I'd say Manic Miner rather than Super Mario platformers. Those are the ones that have stayed with me. I'm very strangely split between the two. I'll play platform games. Like, I've really enjoyed Super Meat Boy on both Steam and on 360. But then I'll also play Deus Ex, Human Revolution, Skyrim, Fallout 3, and New Vegas. So, and they're of course very much not Twitch arcade games, but I go from one to the other. And yeah, I do enjoy a lot of the ones which hark back to simple game mechanics. Something doesn't have to be complicated to have a really good risk reward system on it. A good example of an update which stayed true to the original would be the Pac-Man Championship Edition and DX. And anyone played those?
No, I haven't, unfortunately.
Oh, you should.
Yeah, I used to love Pac-Man, I must admit.
Well, if you can imagine Pac-Man, but they've altered the game mechanic so that when you eat a certain amount of dots, or you eat a power-up, it will change the maze on one side of the screen. And then you go over to that side of the screen, eat the dots, change the configuration of the other side of the maze.
Oh, cool.
And you've got a countdown clock.
Yeah.
So you've got a limit there. And it's a very good way of playing with the game mechanics. So it's different to just having the static maps. But it's quite true to the spirit of the original.
That's cool.
Seriously, go download the demo.
Yeah, no, I will do. Fair enough.
Okay. All right. So, Cookie, what are your first gaming memories?
Also, sorry for rambling on there.
I'll apologise for rambling straight away then. Okay, so my first gaming memory was with my granddad. Bless him. I was around about 5 at the time, and my granddad used to work for the Civil Aviation Authority, and he used to be over in America and Hong Kong a lot, and he loved his gadgets, and I visited him one time, and he'd got this new Atari system, video computer system. I don't know what model it was, it might have been the 2600 or one after that, but it was the first time I'd ever laid eyes on a games console.
Yeah.
And I remember he basically sat me in front of the telly, gave me this little joystick, and suddenly Snoopy was on the screen, and I was controlling him. It was Snoopy and the Red Baron.
Yes. The game.
Yeah. On his little kennel, and I was taking to the skies and shooting things down, and I loved it. It was brilliant. I was just sat there, and I was like, wow, I'm in control of the telly. Cool.
That was the thing, wasn't it? It was actually being able to control what was going on the TV. That was just amazing.
It was. It was brilliant. You never thought he'd be able to do it, to be fair. Then a couple of years later, my mum and dad bought a BBC Micro. And I remember playing text games on it where there was no pictures. You just typed in the directions you wanted the character to go in. And there was a Spider-Man game, and it used to wind me up something chronic because I'd get to this room, Sandman was there, and it'd be, Reb, Sandman in the face. Sorry, you cannot do that.
Yeah.
Jump to the ceiling. Sorry, you can't do that. Run out the door. The door is locked. You cannot do that. Okay.
I do not understand. Please yeah, retype the question.
But that also came with Asteroids, which I loved. The original Asteroids, that was brilliant. I used to sit there for hours playing that. Then I got the, what did you call it? The Ginger Child console?
Yeah. I was brought a stepchild of.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was brought an Amstrad CPC 464 for Christmas, and I loved it. It came with the tape deck and everything, and it used to have the little squiggly lines on the front as you loaded it up, and you'd sit there making a cup of coffee, waiting for it to load the tapes up. I remember actually playing a lot of games developed by Ocean at the time, like RoboCop.
Ocean were quite good on the CPC.
Yeah, I loved
very good looking games.
They were. RoboCop was brilliant. And I remember actually being able to bike into my local newsagents, which was 2 miles down the road.
Yeah.
Or one of them. And they would actually have Codemasters games on in tape in the rails, and they were $4.99 a piece.
So $4.99?
Yeah. This is going back. Yeah. Around about $4.99.
Yep. Weren't they supposed to be about $2.99?
I was from Norfolk. They could obviously charge me whatever they liked. It's the closest place for me to get a game. But they did, Codemasters did Dizzy. And I remember Dizzy is always me. And they also did some very, looking back at it, very good games with Hanna-Barbera games, I think it was. Or that was a different developer. But they used to have Draw McGraw and Tom and Jerry and all sorts.
That was high-tech software.
Ah, that was high tech, was it? Okay, yep. So I apologise, Codemasters, that was high tech. But so I used to go down there and grab the latest Dizzy game, grab the latest Hanna-Barbera game, which was cool. And I remember one particular game called Friday the 13th.
Oh, that terrified me when I first played it.
Which was, I would spend hours there because you're this little sprite and you could literally, you walk from around the camp into different areas, and all you literally had to do was find out who was which camper was really Jason and about to kill somebody else, and kill Jason before they killed somebody else.
Yes. So
I actually managed to work out that if you just went on a rampage killing everybody, you would find out who was Jason quicker, and you wouldn't die for some reason. So I just did that.
I'm glad you didn't go into law enforcement at this point.
I just sat there with that. I was thinking, this is getting a bit boring now, waiting for him to reveal himself. Wonder if this will work. Dang. Oh, it does work. Okay, cool. So,
that's one way of doing it, I suppose.
Yeah. Why wait? They only blame Jason for the deaths anyway. So.
Oh, well, there you go. It turns out the player is Jason.
Yeah. Make it a little bit more interesting. And then I turned to consoles. I saw on telly an advert for a Sega Master System.
Oh, yes.
Sonic the Hedgehog and Alex Kidd. And I actually saved up a minute and got myself the Master System. And I've been into consoles with a few with a bit of a PC era in between. But mainly I've been console since then. Since booting up Alex Kidd and Sonic the Hedgehog, that was, platformers. And I still enjoy good platformers. Super Meat Boy, brilliant game.
Excellent,
love that. I have to say, I very, very, in the hopes of it having some redemption, I did get Sonic Generations. They did remind me a lot of the old Sonic games. So I did actually quite enjoy Sonic Generations.
Oh.
Quite a good buy. So.
I was just thinking that if we do have American listeners, hello, we should point out that for some reason, I'm not entirely sure why, well, the NES reigned supreme in the US, and the Master System was very much a, why are you bothering with that when there's a NES? The Master System was much bigger than the NES. In the UK, in Europe.
Yes,
really?
Yeah. A lot bigger. because you one of the I think they did a big promo with Indiana Jones when that first came out, because it was one of the that the Master System had the license for Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, I think it was.
Yeah.
It's the on the Master System, and at that point, that was really the first big advertised game that I'd ever seen on the telly that was advertised as, you know, a movie, proper tie-in and everything else. You'd got RoboCop and that sort of thing for motion, but you didn't see it plastered on the telly between all your cartoons and stuff.
Yeah, and I have no idea why, but the NES was quite late releasing over here, or it seemed very late.
I mean, my sister actually had an NES, and I did play on the NES, and one of my favourite platform games, although it was absolutely annoying because I could never ever get past it, it was fiendishly difficult, and that was Chippendale Rescue Rangers.
Oh, that.
Yeah.
I thought how difficult that was.
I thought I'd complete that one.
Show off. You know, so yeah. So,
okay.
And I admit I was a big Sega fanboy.
Now, I'll just chip in here. I forgot to ask. Well, I forgot to mention LED games. Did you play any of those, Paul? Everett?
LED games such as
Firefox, Puck Monster, things like that.
Not that I can think of, no.
Sort of the Tomy battery-powered things.
Yes. Yes, I believe. Yeah, it rings a bell now.
Yeah, those were things which. It was before a lot of the 8-bit computers were gaining a lot of, you know, huge market penetration, and Argos and things like that had a lot of, you know, about £25-30 games, and they'd have their own little built-in screen, and they'd be built up with little coloured LEDs or LEDs with little colour overlays on them, and so effectively all the sprites would be predefined.
Yes.
But you had some quite good versions of things like Pac-Man and Space Invaders and things like that.
Pac-Man is one that I've actually played on the LED ones, actually.
I've got a few in my loft.
Really?
I actually had a big... I don't know where my dad got it from. I had a big game, and it was called Mario Cement Factory, and that had its own little screen with a little joystick and an A and B button, and all you had to do was go across and get the cement mixers. But because it was all predefined, if you put it in the light, you could actually see where the LEDs would suddenly light up next.
If anyone's a little bit confused as to what I mean by LED with predefined graphics, if you can imagine, similar to Game & Watch.
Yeah.
With the liquid crystal display. And you could hold those up to the light and you could see, you know, as you said, you could see all the sprites.
Yes.
Where they could be. And with these, they were LED games, so that they had the massive advantage of fewer people had TVs in their rooms. So if you wanted to play on a computer or on a games console, traditionally they had to take up the living room TV. Mm. And the parents hated that.
Yes.
So the whole idea of something that had an inbuilt display, massive appeal to the parents, because it was, you can shut up. You know, what, you know, one of your poles, or an Emily, just give them this, shoo them to their own room, or they can play it behind the sofa while waiting for Doctor Who, and you can watch whatever you want on TV instead of having to put up with them with a little jumping man running through a forest. So yeah, LED games were popular before home computers really started to pick off, you know, kick off in the UK. And we had a nice 8-bit computer period.
We did.
That the US didn't really get. The US had the Nintendo Entertainment System and then continued on through consoles. We only really started picking up on gamers' consoles when it got to the Super Nintendo and the Mega Drive, I think.
Yeah. No, it was... like I say, it was the Master System for me. Then I migrated to the Mega Drive.
I think the Master System was the first one that I saw being kind of a big deal in shops.
Yeah, it was... I still quite like those consoles as well, to be fair.
They're quite good.
No, they had some classic titles on there, I must admit. So, and but I think during that time it was a bit like now, where you're getting lots of first-person shooters. At that time, especially the 16-bit era of the Mega Drive and SNES, we did get flooded with platformer after platformer.
Yeah.
You know,
it seems to be cyclical, depending on the hardware and depending on the styles of the time. It seemed to be 8-bit consoles were platformers.
Oh, yes.
And that carried over into the 16-bit, but that also started a lot of racing games.
Fighters.
Scrolling beat-em-ups, yeah.
Beat of Rage.
Yeah, and...
Double Dragon.
Yeah, scrolling shoot-em-ups as well.
Yeah.
Scrolling shoot-em-ups is something that almost died when it got to the PlayStation age.
Yeah, it did.
Pretty pity.
It is... I was Gunstar Heroes.
Oh, that was a fantastic game.
Sure that was on...
I'm pretty sure that's available on XBLA now.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I'm pretty sure.
If it's not, there's the Mega Drive collection.
Yes.
Still awake, Emily?
Yeah, I'm awake. It's just you're all talking about things that I have no recollection of.
Boo, youngster, boo.
It's worse. It's worse than that. The reasons actually behind it, but I think we should move on to Paul B's first gaming memories and how it's influenced his gaming taste today.
Okay, so, well, I'll try and be a bit shorter. So I originally started out on the ZX Spectrum.
Yay!
Originally boo. The 48K. Was that boo?
Yeah.
pay no attention as CPC owner. See, the thing is, in the playground, bitter rivalry between the Spectrum and the Commodore 64 owners, but we could always unite against the ginger-haired stepchild CPC owner.
Mummy.
I started out with ZX Spectrum. When I really started to like games was actually playing the Dizzy games.
Yeah.
That's when I really kind of... I've never been a massive fan of arcade style, kind of get as far as you can and get the high score type thing. I've never really been a fan of those personally. I like the kind of more adventure kind of style ones like Dizzy and even Seymour Goes to Hollywood as well. That was actually made by the same people. I eventually managed to get like a ZX Spectrum 12 8K, which actually had the tape deck in built with it, which was a lot better.
That's a plus two.
Plus two.
Yeah.
So plus three, I think I did get like years and years and years later.
Yeah.
But there wasn't any kind of discs around for it. So, it had like a slightly larger than floppy disk size.
Three-inch floppy disks, which only Amstrad used. Mm.
Yes.
Yeah. They were crap. That's what's wrong with them.
I remember there was actually a bug on one of the games, which was basically because with the Spectrum games, I think you could play the 48K version on a 12.8K Spectrum, but obviously not the other way around. And there was one problem with Spellbound Dizzy, I believe, where when you're talking to one of the characters, he doesn't actually respond in the 48K version. It was a bug that actually made the game unbeatable.
Whoops.
Yeah.
Because you were just standing in front of the character going, go on, everyone's saying I should speak to you, and you say what to do next, and you go,
Exactly,
shrug.
Yeah.
before the days of patches and downloads of updates.
Absolutely.
Yeah, in those days, the patch was to send it back to the company and hope that they had a new version.
Yeah. If not, then you've got a game that you literally can't beat.
Yeah, you're screwed.
Yep, exactly. And then I moved on to the NES. I remember being really, really excited about it because it's like you can stick it in, boot it up, and you instantly play. It's amazing. Didn't have to kind of wait for loading screens and whatnot.
Yes.
I remember basically because obviously tapes you could quite easily pirate. So yes. Obviously kind of record from one onto another. But obviously the quality went, was lost in it. So sometimes when you're actually playing or trying to play pirate games, it might actually kind of reset halfway through loading it, which was really annoying.
Yeah. R-type loading error.
Hmm.
That was the common one.
Yeah. And I remember actually I was able to program in the tune for Frere Jacques on the ZX Spectrum as well.
when the games machines that you had, you could actually do other things with them.
Yes. Anyway, I eventually moved on to the NES, then got into obviously the games like Super Mario Bros. And Mega Man.
Mm.
I remember Mega Man used to be... they had an interesting way of kind of progressing, because obviously with previous games, previous NES games without memory, you'd have to make sure that it's fairly playable without, too much hassle. But obviously with stuff like, before Legend of Zelda and Metroid, where you could actually save, you actually had, like, passwords.
Yes. Whatnot,
which can be good, but can be bad, because I remember having a copy of Snake's Revenge, which was like the semi-sequel to Metal Gear.
Yeah.
And that basically had, literally the alphabet kind of tapping in thing. But I think it was like 24 characters long per password or something like that.
Oh, God.
So, if you kind of accidentally wrote it down wrong, or, your handwriting was slightly illegible, then you can't actually go back to where you were, pretty much. Which, caused a bit of stir. But,
yeah, the whole thing's like, is that a zero or an O if they didn't have the line through? And is that an I or a one?
Exactly. After it was actually quite a while after the NES that I actually got the N64. So I my parents didn't actually have enough money to get like a SNES or anything. I've always been like a Nintendo person myself, although I have played a lot of Sega as well, mostly Mega Drive. Getting N64, GoldenEye, usual thing, and then kind of progressed on from there, really.
How would you say that it's influenced your taste today? What kind of games do you find yourself leaning towards more than others?
Well, I think basically because my main kind of gaming history kind of obviously spans, especially in my youth, it spans kind of going from 2D to 3D. I think I'm fairly okay with most games, to be honest. There's not like a type of game that I wouldn't kind of play. I like a lot of action, I like adventure, I like platforming, I like shoot 'em ups, racing games, everything. So I don't think there's a specific type of game that I would not go near, to be honest.
Okay. Do people want to know what my first gaming memories are?
Yes, go on, humiliate us.
It was more like humiliating myself, it feels like. I had a childhood where I didn't actually get to play games. I occasionally watched other people playing games and didn't really have a clue as to what was going on. I believe I've watched people play Amiga 600, maybe. I think a Mega Gear might have been... Is it Mega Gear?
Game Gear.
Game Gear, yeah, Game Gear, yeah, Game the Gear. Handheld, the Sega handheld was involved at one point, and maybe even old actual Game Boy. But my first actual, I got to play it, game was Pokemon Blue on the Game Boy Color. I mean, it was obviously released for the Game Boy Color. I just happened to be given a Game Boy Color and Pokemon Blue because cool. at the time I'd gone absolutely doodah over Pokemon because it was around the time that it hit the UK. And I got the game on launch. And, of course, I chose Squirtle as my first Pokemon.
Of course.
Basically, I ended up playing a lot of Pokemon for about a year. And so this was around, was it, that would have been about 99 that this happened. Oh, so God, I didn't actually start playing video games until I was about 12 or 13. Didn't actually start playing. Until I was 12 or 13.
Blimey. That,
yeah, basically. and then, like, I got, like, the odd sort of game for my Game Boy Color. I remember somebody gave me Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening, which I did try playing, and this was still before the days of having, like, lots of walkthroughs and stuff online or anything.
Yeah.
And I got stuck on some, like, the second or third dungeon and just gave up and just...
Well, I can understand that, because once you come up against something like that, it is like a brick wall, and it's so frustrating. Yeah.
So I basically banned that, and I would basically just keep going back to Pokemon. I saved up, and then I bought Pokemon Red as well, and so I started like trying to complete Pokedexes, which was a bit more believable back then, when it was 150, or if you had like a download, 151 Pokemon. That was doable. You could do that. I wouldn't say the same today.
No.
The next sort of thing happened. It was actually quite a surprise. My gran won a PlayStation 1 in a competition.
Cool.
Blimey.
And that came with Army Men 3D. You know, the game with the green plastic. Yeah. And hardly played that. Then we picked up some other games. Like, I think, because they decided to give it to my brother, my middle brother. He was my youngest brother at that time. And he didn't really have a clue what was going on. And I'd occasionally play on it and stuff. And then somebody got him, like, a platformer game tie-in for, I think it was either Toy Story or Toy Story 2. I think probably Toy Story 2. And he sort of played that a bit, but he would get bored with that. And my dad bought a couple of racing games for himself, and he liked playing F1.
Yeah.
Like F1 2000 or something. That was okay. And then I saw, I don't think I saw an ad or anything. I just think I just saw it in the store when it was, when Game used to be Electronics Boutique. And they had Final Fantasy VIII. And I was like, that looks interesting. So I asked for it for Christmas. And I'm not sure, I think this was a year after it came out, because it was the Platinum Edition that I initially got. And, again, it's a Japanese game. Technically, both were role-playing games, and I absolutely fell in love with Final Fantasy VIII. I played that game to death. And amongst the guys in my school, who wouldn't believe me, I told them that I knew how to defeat the Black Widow within the time limit when you're on the seed mission at the beginning of the game.
And they were, yeah, right.
Yeah, they were, yeah, right, it's not possible. And I was like, no, it is possible. What I could never get through to them was the fact that it took about 20 to 30 hours worth of grinding before you got to that stage for you to be in a position to do that, because it involved having all the right junction abilities, like element, attack, J and stuff, on the summons, on the GFs, and obviously making sure that, and by that point, Squall's going to be at least like level 30 something, and the other guys are going to be in sort of 20s. So you're drawing like third level elemental magic from enemies by that stage. So you basically end up, everyone's got like Thundergear equipped to like elemental attack J. And that's how it's possible. With a combination of basically letting people fall into limit break danger and occasionally summoning, but not always. So it's doable, but that was the second game I ever properly played and completed.
Can I just say that I've witnessed you doing that?
Yes.
I've witnessed you grinding and grinding and grinding and beating Black Widow, and you just kind of stroll back onto the ship.
Yeah. Well, what giant robot with numerous legs that's trying to kill us? Ha!
that thing.
Yeah, that thing. But so that was the second game I proper played. And basically, with the PlayStation 1 in the house, I just basically became a bit of a Final Fantasy fangirl. I wouldn't really play any of the games. My dad got a PC specifically of a high enough spec to help me do a GMVQ and ICT. When I started year 10, and this was back in the day when free games came with PCs that weren't necessarily Minesweeper, but actual proper published games. So with the PC that he bought, SimCity 3000 came with it. I never managed to get my head around it, so I didn't really play it that much. But there was Need for Speed 3, and was it Soul Descent 3? Soul Ascent. You piloted a craft around a weird sort of alien or spacey kind of
Descent.
Yeah, Soul Descent or Descent.
Yeah, Descent.
Descent. 3.
Yeah.
So it came with those three games, and I'd occasionally play Need for Speed 3 and Descent 3. Need for Speed 3 was awesome because of finding like all the sort of secret shortcuts and stuff. And I do believe you could actually play at least two people on a PC with it. So my cousins would come round, and one person would have one side of the keyboard.
Yeah.
They would have the other side of the keyboard and kind of race each other and hit each other so that the other would lose.
Awesome.
So yeah, and you know, and basically I ended up getting like on the PS1. I was still playing on that though mostly. So I got Final Fantasy IX when it came out. In fact, it actually came out near my birthday, so I was able to actually have that as a birthday present. And then I went back and got Final Fantasy VII, because I haven't played that. And Final Fantasy VII I still haven't completed. After all these years. It'll happen one day, but what platform it might happen on and in what year is two things I'm unsure about. Anyway... And then, basically, because obviously, I mean, I was still playing on the Game Boy occasionally, and that later got upgraded to like a Game Boy Advance when that came out. And I was still playing Pokemon, and I followed the Pokemon series quite sort of closely up until about, I think, Sapphire Ruby, and then I got like the remakes of Red and Blue, so Fire Red and Thingamabob. So Pokemon, my interest in that series has certainly dissipated over the years. I like going back and playing the first few games, but that's it, because the amount of Pokemon that there are now to collect is just insane. And I don't care if they've got the Global Exchange Center stuff and all that and everything. It's impossible. And the fact that there's like ones that you can only get from download centers or from tournaments and that, I just find that incredibly unfair, being somebody who lives in the middle of nowhere in Cornwall.
Yeah, there's making things rare, and then there's making things almost impossible.
Yeah. And so basically, it's like Black and White 2 coming out. I have no interest in that now. I'd much rather go back and replay Blue than anything else. Going back to the PS side of things, well done for finishing my GCSEs and happy 16th birthday, my parents bought me a PS2.
16th birthday, oh God.
Yeah. and with that PS2 came Final Fantasy X. You see, I hadn't even asked for this, and my parents realised, she likes Final Fantasy games.
What could we possibly buy for her on this new machine?
Exactly. So I basically spent the extended summer of finishing my GCSEs and before I started college playing Final Fantasy X and getting absolutely lost in Blitzball mainly.
That's an awesome.
And basically what happened was I was very sort of like not playing a huge variety of things. It was mostly just Final Fantasy and a bit of Pokemon until I met Paul.
And then it was slippery slope there with gaming.
Yeah, there was a slippery slope there. Yeah. And then before I knew it, I was playing Conker's Bad Fur Day, Resident Evil, and you know, Perfect Dark and GoldenEye, because he had an N6, his N64 was working, it still works. And also his GameCube, so he introduced me to Eternal Darkness, which is
the darker side of gaming.
Which is one of my favourite games of all time now. And yeah, basically, I haven't. But I mean, it's kind of weird to think that I went from being somebody who just liked playing Pokemon Blue to being absolutely lethal on Resident Evil 4. I kid you not, I have had obsessive periods with that game. Conquered it on 3 different formats now. So PS2,
yeah.
PS2, the Wii Edition, and the HD remake on 360. Completely. Sort of destroyed. And out of the three, it's the Wii Edition that I like the most. In fact, if there's any reason for me ever to own a Nintendo Wii, it's to play a Resident Evil 4 Wii Edition. Because
is that with the Wiimote controls?
With the Wiimote controls.
Yeah.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's the best Wii motion game on the system to me.
I've got that on both GameCube and on Wii. And a lot of people might say, "Oh, you've got the same version then twice."
Hey.
But yeah, I do want to play. I bought it specifically because I thought, oh, the Wiimote controls for, you know, aiming and everything like that would just work so well.
I mean, obviously, because the fact that the Wii version ended up with all the extras that the PS2 version got.
That annoyed me so much at the time.
Yeah. Which obviously the GameCube version didn't have. One thing that it was kind of weird, because Paul picked up, like, before Resident Evil 4 was released, like an independent like Nintendo magazine of some sort, and yeah. It had like a game trailers disc on it, and it was kind of indicating back then that maybe you'd be able to use like the chainsaw or something, because you'd actually have melee weapons beyond a knife. Am I remembering this right? Or something.
I'm not entirely sure about that.
But there were things in the trailer that didn't end up making it into the main game, wasn't there?
Basically, because the story with Resident Evil 4 goes that basically early in its development, they went so left field with it that basically what was meant to be Resident Evil 4 actually became Devil May Cry.
Yes, I heard that. I was listening to a podcast just yesterday, I think. And it was like, really? I can't see Devil May Cry being Resident Evil-y in any way.
No, I can't.
Just mad. But yeah, I've heard that too.
Oh, I think there's also another game that's kind of claimed huge amounts of my time. Actually, two. And they're actually on PC, despite my console obsession. Oh. Just a bit.
Okay.
That would be my parents calling my gran. Just give us a pause a minute, and I'll continue. Okay. So I was saying, there's, other than my console obsession, I actually did play two particular games on PC quite obsessively. And this was after I was given a laptop.
Yeah.
And that was the original Sims, and the first expansion pack for that, I believe, and also Morrowind, which I bought myself. I went into an independent games retailer one day and said, I got these specs on my laptop. I want to play a role-playing game. Hit me with something.
Yeah.
And they were like, here, have this secondhand copy of Morrowind. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. You know, this is back in the days when you could actually have secondhand PC games.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
So I have actually, I've been gaming long enough to at least experience there actually being a secondhand market for pre-owned PC games. I sort of sat down with Morrowind on my laptop and became obsessed with that. And it's a game that I keep coming back to. Admittedly, though, I have a habit of cheating on it somewhat. With the console, depending on how I feel, sometimes I'll play by the rules. Other times I'm like, "Oh, I have myself 100 gold here, 1,000 gold there. Maybe I'll increase a stat to maybe 100. maybe I won't. Depends how the mood takes me. But I have played Morrowind, and I have a sad tale about Morrowind. I managed to complete it, and complete a house line and most of the miscellaneous quests in it. And then, once upon a time, I decided I'd install Neverwinter Nights on my laptop.
Oh.
In theory, it would run. In theory, it would work. What Neverwinter Nights did, though, was it destroyed almost every game install I had on my system, including my save, so I lost all my Morrowind stuff. I lost all my stuff for The Sims.
Oh, God.
It was carnage of save files, unbeknownst to man before this point. I couldn't believe it. I was
That was a rather well-known, really big problem with the original release of Neverwinter Nights. I remember that. Sin had the same problem as well. Shooter.
Yeah, I wasn't told at the time that I bought. I mean, I bought it. This, oh, yeah. I bought brand new. In fact, I don't even think it was an original. I think it was like one of the cheapo packaged editions. You know that you got like the cheap PC games. Mm. And I was so disgusted with what it had done. I took it back and demanded my money back and got it back.
Blimey.
And then had to set up in order to undo the damage. I had to do a complete system reinstall. Of my laptop, and then start games again.
God, I think you must be the only person in the UK that has ever got their money back from a PC game.
Yeah.
I was pretty convincing. I might have scared the, at that point, game staff.
I can imagine the righteous rage caused by having all your save games erased. It would be a terrifying thing if you were some poor assistant. It's not worth my life to say no. In this case, yes, just take your money, leave me alone, it's not my fault.
The incident certainly has made me never want to play Neverwinter Nights. And when they announced, whilst Atari still owned the rights to it, but Neverwinter Nights 2, essentially, and I was just like, I was just having flashbacks to the evening when I did the game install, and I was just like, no, you can't do that to the populace again, and just kind of rage quit from the internet for a while, due to the news.
I can see it now. I am Inigo Montoya. You deleted my saves. Prepare to die.
As a note, I've continued with the Elder Scrolls franchise and been pleasantly surprised on the front of Final Fantasy. I haven't been happy since 10 with Final Fantasy games. I have bought 12. I haven't played 11 because I don't do MMOs. Bought 13. I didn't complete 12. I completed 13. Haven't touched 14. I think hardly anyone touches 14 these days.
Especially
yeah.
That reboot thing.
No, 14's the other MMO version, and then 13.2, which I started playing, and then I earlier this year I haven't gone back to it.
Did you know there's going to be a 13.3?
With lightning? Yes. I heard about this, and I was just thinking to myself, why can't you just go back to the days of Final Fantasy X and maybe even a bit further back?
I have to say, my future brother-in-law has exactly the same experience with Final Fantasy. Massive Final Fantasy fan. 4, 5, 6, so far as I remember, he's played 4. But, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10... absolutely loves them. When it comes to the ones after that, yeah. And I just mentioned 13.2 to him, and he just pulled a face. I'll call it the Phantom Menace face.
Yeah.
Where it's just, I love this. What have they done? Why did they do that? But I can't help myself. I have to consume it.
Yeah, I think after my experiences of 12, 13 was a bit of a morbid curiosity thing. And yeah.
We've played,
I'm sorry.
The remakes on the was it the DS?
Yeah.
So we've played those as well.
They've also was it Final Fantasy 13 is on iOS and Android as well, the remake.
A couple of the Final Fantasy ones are, yeah. The remakes. Mm. Final Fantasy 3, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, after, ending on that disappointing note, as we lament what the hell Square Enix is doing with the Final Fantasy franchise.
Nobody knows.
Yeah,
Phantom Menacing.
Yes, repeatedly. Yeah.
I don't think they know, do they?
Probably not at this point, sad to say. I think they kind of got caught in the sequel trap. And
oh, yes.
It's not just that, but I mean, if you think about it, there's quite a few of the people that have actually kind of left to do other things like The Last Story.
Mm.
So it's not even helmed by the same people, really.
And that can be a good thing because you get fresh blood, but it's when they still seem to be playing within the same sandbox.
I think they could have done with fresh blood in terms of at least maybe making sure the stories were still interesting and that, but it's what they've done with the mechanics that's the most brutal part of everything since after 10. That's what makes it so just, oh my lord, why?
I think part of the problem, because obviously they wanted to go the whole action route, and I think part of that was actually because they inspired themselves by the film Advent Children, Final Fantasy VII Advent Children.
Which so they, I quite since then, liked.
Yeah, the Blu-ray version is much better than the DVD version. There's the Blu-ray Complete that actually has like tons of redone scenes in it and actually makes more sense.
I didn't know that.
Yep. But I think overall, They've obviously got tried to make it more action-y, less kind of turn-based, and I think that has really kind of lost a lot of the magic to it.
Yeah. Speaking generally, Western RPGs needed a lot of catch-up when the Final Fantasy games were first making it big over in the West. And they were quite archaic because they were so rooted in PCs. But Western RPGs like Mass Effect and the Fallouts and the Elder Scrolls games have come a long way. And Japanese RPGs seem to have festered. They've stagnated.
Yeah. Mm.
And they're just not as interesting or as fresh as they were. But whereas you can see a massive difference between a Western RPG 10 years ago and now, you don't really see that big a difference apart from a graphical update with the JRPGs. It's disappointing.
Okay. Well, again, on that disappointing note, I think really, truly, this is all we have time for this week.
I think we've gone over time.
Goodbye from me. You can find me on Twitter at EK6891.
It's a good night from me, Paul, a.k.a. Retroid on Eurogamer.net and Super Retroid on Twitter.
And it's good night from me, Paul, a.k.a. OneArmed_Cookie on Twitter. And you can also find me lurking around the GameJar.com.
Okay, and it's a good night from me. I'm Paul Blewett on Twitter, and I have a website. It's mostly about video editing, so that's kind of what I do. It's paul-blewett.com.
And you can obviously find Nerds Assemble on Twitter at Nerds Podcast. You can find our website at www.nerdsassemble.co.uk. We're on Facebook under Nerds Assemble Podcasts, and there may be a Google Plus page lurking somewhere. This was episode 6, and good night.
Good night.